Third case, Bentz v. City of Kendallville. Mr. Myers.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The appellant is Susan Bentz, the personal representative of Dr. Leonelli, who has now died since the since the facts of this case. On May 3, 2006, Dr. Leonelli burned
We'd better discuss that, the issue, whether the claim survives his death. What I don't understand, so there's a long list of, exclusions from survival in the Indiana law. So, what is the theory that underlies these exclusions? Why these and in particular?
Your Honor, I don't know. I looked for the legislative history behind many of these exclusions. It just so happens that in Indiana there's not a lot.
Cases ever discuss it? Is this common? Do other states exclude so many torts?
They do. In this particular case...
Well, why do you think they do?
Well, Your Honor, I think that they try and prevent perhaps... bad claims or fraudulent claims or claims that don't have any proof. Many times the decedent is the only one who has the proof necessary to go forward. Perhaps that's a reason. But in Indiana...
That would apply to this case.
Well, only to some of the claims, Judge. With respect to the claim of false arrest... And trespass, which is akin to physical entry under the Fourth Amendment.
Well, he dropped the trespass claim.
The state claim, we did. Because Indiana has a very broad immunity statute, and I don't think there's any dispute but the fact that these officers were there enforcing a law. But we never dropped the physical entry portion of the Fourth Amendment claim. And with respect to Indiana's survival statute, what the Supreme Court and the Seventh Circuit commands us to do is to go back and look at closely analogous state tort claims.
Well, doesn't the Indiana law say the invasion of privacy is a Fourth Amendment matter?
Under Cullison versus Medley, that's correct, but Cullison was a wrongful search case. In this case, what we're maintaining is that under the Fourth Amendment, the wrongful physical entry claim goes forward as well as the false arrest. And that actually, the two meld together. Because Officer Davis, in this case, had to cross the...
Well, it also covers false imprisonment. I don't understand this distinction between false imprisonment and false arrest.
All right. False arrest is the initial seizure of an individual without probable cause. False imprisonment is the continued unlawful imprisonment after that seizure. For example... Let's say that an individual is arrested.
Is there any Indiana case that says that?
Your Honor, I cited those cases. I think Roe versus Holt was one. It was reversed on other grounds. But there's no Indiana case directly dealing with this situation. But if I could continue with my example, it might make it clear.
So he was in jail for what, 8 hours or 5 hours?
Your Honor, it was less than a day. That's true.
Pardon?
It was less than a day. That's accurate.
Well, can't you bring a false imprisonment claim when you're falsely imprisoned for less than a day?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that you probably can.
So then what's the difference between false arrest and... I mean, obviously, false arrest adds something to false imprisonment because you could be imprisoned without an arrest. I mean, we could lock the door behind you and imprison you here indefinitely without arresting you. So.
True. But I think
isn't every false arrest a false imprisonment?
I'm not sure that it is. But I think that if I'm not sure that it is.
No. Why isn't it? I'm saying it is, because every false arrest is a detention, however brief, and if it's groundless, it's a false imprisonment.
Because false arrest deals with the absence of probable cause. False imprisonment doesn't necessarily deal with that element. For example, you may have a Gersten versus Pugh action where...
No, I'm saying every false arrest is also a false imprisonment.
Your Honor, I'm not sure I agree with that.
An example of a false arrest that wasn't a false imprisonment.
Let's say that you have a false arrest where someone is wrongfully seized without probable cause, but that individual is only momentarily
But it wasn't momentarily here. It was hours.
It was hours. But you just asked me.
Why isn't that imprisonment?
Well, you asked me to give you an example. I'm trying.
Okay, you gave an example. But what about this case? Why isn't this an imprisonment case?
Because the imprisonment.
Jail. We call that imprisonment.
Your Honor, the period of time after the seizure is the imprisonment. The seizure itself is the false arrest. Indiana law has never, I do not believe.
But your damages would be based on the length of time that he was in jail.
The damages are also based upon the illegality of the false arrest without probable cause. The seizure itself and how wrongful it was, going into a man's home.
You're doing false imprisonment also. I don't know why you couldn't always bring a false arrest case as a false imprisonment case. Are there cases which say you can't do that?
Your Honor,
cases where people's false imprisonment claims are thrown out because the court says this is false arrest, this is not false imprisonment.
Your Honor, I've not read those cases. I know that I believe that it was Judge Mathias in one of the cases cited in my jurisdictional statement delineated the difference between false imprisonment and false arrest. And again, it has to do with the fact that
there may be differences. There are differences, but it's not clear that there are obviously false imprisonments which have nothing whatsoever to do with arrest.
I agree.
You just don't like someone, you lock them up. It has nothing to do with arrest. But it doesn't follow from that that there are false arrests which are not false imprisonments, right?
Your Honor, I suppose that's true, but I think
I
that we have.
I can't think of any false arrest that isn't a false imprisonment. Even your momentary example is not clear. I mean, an arrest is a detention, even if it's very brief. Otherwise, not an arrest. That's what arrest means. You stop someone.
Well, arrest means is taking somebody into custody. It's the imprisonment after the custody, which is the false imprisonment claim. They're
the
not
false
exactly
imprisonment
the same.
Begins with the arrest.
It does begin with the arrest. And so it is different.
No, it's not different.
Your Honor,
anyway,
I beg to differ.
Why not invasion of privacy? Why isn't that also the privacy tort? Doesn't that encompass breaking an entry and so on, and barging into someone's house? Searches.
Illegal search.
Yeah.
And that was the example in Collison versus Medley. Indiana has talked about that.
Well, that's what this is. This is an illegal search, right?
Part of the claim was an illegal search claim. We did bring that up. But it's not the claim that goes forward under the survivability statute. Even if the survivability
what
statute...
What goes forward and what doesn't as to this?
The false arrest goes forward, the wrongful physical...
No, we discussed that. I'm talking about invasion of privacy.
I'm not sure that any of the invasion of privacy goes forward.
Well, search or seizure. What? Fourth Amendment, what goes forward?
Under Fourth Amendment, what goes forward is the wrongful physical entry.
What physical injury?
Okay. There was no physical injury. In fact, we've never pled a physical injury in this case. This case was never about
that.
That's
what you just said went forward, didn't you?
No, sir.
Maybe I don't understand you.
I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
I said what goes forward? What's still alive here of the Fourth Amendment?
The Fourth Amendment false arrest claim remains alive, and the Fourth Amendment wrongful entry into the residence remains alive.
Entry.
Why isn't the wrongful entry an illegal search?
But Your Honor, you can enter for several purposes. Only searching the person would be one among them. One would be also an arrest.
Isn't barging into someone's house without authority, isn't that an invasion of privacy?
Not necessarily.
You know, privacy includes seclusion, right? If you keep, making nuisance phone calls to me every night, that's an invasion of my privacy.
Right.
So how's that different if you come barging into my house every night?
Let's say that you barge into somebody's home and he's hosting a neighborhood party, and he has a lot of friends over. Okay. Let's say that the doors are open but the screen doors are shut. He's not secluded. He's not in solitude.
Oh, please. That's like saying that, if two people are having sex and you barge into the room, there's no invasion of privacy because there's more than one person there.
Well, I'm not going to touch that one, Judge.
Well, really, that would be a classic example of invasion of privacy.
Well, The Indiana legislature presumably knows the difference between false arrest and false imprisonment.
Apparently it doesn't, because according to you, there's no theory behind this list of torts. It's mindless.
Your Honor, I've reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Well, why don't you take a couple of minutes? We've spent so much time. We'll give you a couple of minutes to discuss the merits.
Okay, thank you. What we're contending in this case is that the wrong standard of review was applied by the district court. The district court basically looked at the case from the eyes of the officers and their own perceptions, not just from the shoes of a reasonable officer. The district court actually...
But I don't understand. What is it you think they did wrong? I mean, it is very strange, the person burning the clothes and then on the lawn, and then someone saying she'd heard a scream.
But
probably not, but the police officer, what are they supposed to do?
Your Honor,
they have to take this seriously, I would think.
Your Honor, you brought up a very good point. The woman screaming.
Well, what do you want the police to do in this situation?
I want them to take down the phone number and address of the person who allegedly heard
before
the woman screaming.
Before they go into the house?
Well, either then or thereafter, but they never did. To this day, we don't know who that witness is, and we went out and canvassed the neighborhood. Now, we did find individuals who said that they spoke with the police, but they never...
I don't understand. What are they supposed to do? They go in, they search the house... And then what? They shouldn't have arrested him? Is that your point? They should have...
Shouldn't have arrested him, Judge. I mean, they went into his house without a warrant.
But they're burning clothes, and then there's the report of a scream. Shouldn't they arrest him while hold him while they're investigating the scream and trying to locate the wife?
Your Honor, you can detain somebody without an arrest while you investigate. There's no need to arrest him. I said you can.
No, there is a need to arrest suspects while you're investigating. All you need is probable cause.
And, Judge, I don't think they had it. A reasonable jury could look at this and say, there's just not enough. You know, you didn't give us the names of the people who apparently reported this screaming woman. Okay, there's no way to verify that information. It's got to be verified. It's got to be trustworthy. It's got to be accurate. There has to be some level of credibility to it. And on these facts, we can't determine what that is.
Well, but they got two 911 calls, and the neighbors are standing outside the house, and he's coming out in and out burning clothes in the front yard.
Yes, sir. That's what he's doing. But that doesn't mean he has to be arrested.
Bizarre behavior.
For a psychologist, no less. That is probably true.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Myers. Ms. Polly?
May it please the Court, Mr. Myers. I'm Linda Polly, and I'm here on behalf of the City of Kendallville. I'm here on behalf of Officers Davis, McCann, Waters, Richardson, and Ritchie. And the first thing that I do want to address, and there's not much left to say because I believe Your Honors have handled that issue of survivability, and correctly so, and Mr. Myers did not have an appropriate response. The bottom line is these claims do not survive the Indiana Survival Statute. No matter how you slice them, they do not survive. Now, interestingly, as was mentioned in Mr. Myers' argument, the trespass claim had been abandoned. That had been abandoned at the summary judgment level by the plaintiff appellant. And it's resurrected itself now that we're here at this level in terms of the word trespass. And as Mr. Myers stated, he is keeping alive that Fourth Amendment claim of wrongful entry. And as has been very, very clear, whether you call that a trespass, a wrongful entry, it is an invasion of privacy. An invasion of privacy by...
Do you have any theory as to why these torts and not others are listed in this as exceptions to survival?
It's my recollection, Your Honor, from the case law that because they are very personal torts. And so when the very person doesn't survive, the personal torts...
Part of the problem is Indiana doesn't have a legislative history, right?
That's true. That is true. So the bottom line is that this Indiana statute is what controls. The Indiana statute lists a list of six things, and they're rather broad categories. If we used every terminology in the dictionary that's synonymous with these terms, the statute would go on forever. But very clearly, Indiana case law has defined invasion of privacy. And very interestingly, a couple of the cases that appellant references in his brief to say this is trespass, he goes back to a couple of 1800 cases, and there's still good case law that say the sanctity of one's home is very, very important. And those old cases use the term trespass. And then there are a couple other cases cited, Castleman and Miller, by appellant, and they also use that word trespass. But what they also do in those cases is they basically say trespass is the invasion of privacy as defined by Indiana law. It's coming into the sanctity of one's home, and it's an invasion of privacy.
Is there a distinct Indiana tort of false arrest?
Not a distinct one, Your Honor. I guess the point that was made earlier is that false imprisonment is the broad category, and false arrest is a subcategory of false imprisonment. So the case that appellant cites, the Roe case, makes the distinction, just as Mr. Myers indicated, in terms of time reference. But as you indicated to him, and as I believe case law indicates, the false imprisonment, as is included in the survival statute, is a very broad category of which false arrest falls within. So although there may be a separate claim of false arrest, false imprisonment covers that. And that is also clear by Indiana case law, which defines false imprisonment as the unlawful restraint of one's freedom of movement and deprivation of one's liberty. So whether that's immediate at the time of the arrest or in the subsequent imprisonment, it is all false imprisonment under Indiana law. And that is why these claims do not survive.
Want to talk about the merits a little?
In moving to the merits, Your Honor, basically the contention of appellant is that the court used the wrong standard. And basically what appellant would want us to do is believe everything from the appellant plaintiff's perspective. And that is not and has never been the law. The evidence before the court, before the district court, still has to be admissible evidence. And the problem that the appellant had in this case was that evidence that they now want you to consider was not admissible. It was stricken by the district court, all of the evidence, in a very well-reasoned decision. For instance, the affidavit of Dr. Leonelli himself. What he did was he controverted in many parts of his affidavit prior testimony that he had given in his deposition. Other things that he did.
This police officer's affidavit was not very credible either, because he claimed he talked to the wife, and she said the order of protection had been violated. So he thought he was talking to the first wife, and he was talking to the second wife, and he thought he was talking to the first wife. So I don't know what we can say about his credibility.
Your Honor, in regard to that issue, he was deposed upon that issue, and that affidavit was put in front of him. And the thing was is that the affidavit was done on the night of the incident. It is dated May 3rd. He was in possession of information that there was a protective order against a Jamie Leonelli. What he didn't know was that there were two wives at that point in time. He did not know that there were two wives. And he made an assumption. And he admitted in his deposition testimony that that was incorrect. But he made an assumption that it was one and the same person. And we go back to that evening and what was evident, a fire on the lawn, neighbors saying that it's another domestic dispute, neighbors telling the various police officers that they heard a woman screaming earlier, and we have to put ourselves in the position of that officer at that point in time, not what he later learned. And at that point in time, the arrest was reasonable, the entry into the home was reasonable, and the search afterward for perhaps a victim
maybe,
or a body.
Maybe the scream wasn't any more credible than a second wife, though.
Your Honor, the cases that appellant cites for having to do an investigation and get more information about that would make sense. Those cases, I'm thinking specifically of the Wheeler case where an investigation was made and an arrest was made 2 months later. There was a lot of time. In this case, again, we have a fire on a lawn. We have neighbors claiming people were screaming. And so to do a thorough investigation before you go in and see if somebody's perhaps in danger would be unreasonable.
How did Dr. Leonelli meet his death?
Dr. Leonelli was driving a motorcycle down Highway 69 between two cars in traffic, and he got caught in between the two cars, and he was killed in a motorcycle accident.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and we'll take the case under advisement, and we'll move on to our next case, Kaplan versus Dupin.